This is 1A. I'm Kimberly Adams in Washington, sitting in for Joshua Johnson. We can all agree, uninvited guests are the worst.
I noticed that the worms in my garden were very active and close to the surface, and that the soil they were leaving behind was very granular, like coffee grounds. I did some research and discovered that there has been an invasion of Asian jumping worms.
We actually have an invasive plant here called poison hemlock. It was brought here from Europe as a pretty garden flower, but it's incredibly poisonous. It has been something that has killed young children, and it also has killed other local rodents that are beneficial to our ecosystem.
I've had a 9-foot, a 10-foot, and a 13-foot python we've killed in my yard. Now we're seeing iguanas, curly tail lizards, Jesus lizards, and true chameleons. And then also we have the typical feral hogs, wild hogs, all the plants in and out of the water, invasive. They're all a nightmare.
Invasive species are a serious threat. The National Wildlife Federation says they put more than 40% of threatened or endangered species at risk. That last caller, talking about the snakes in his yard, that snake is the Burmese python, a non-native invader that has spent the last quarter century decimating Florida's small animal population. Scientists at the Everglades National Park say the reptiles are responsible for a drop in the small mammal population of up to 99%. So where do invasive species come from? Why are they so destructive? And how do we get a handle on them before they eat, strangle, and smother everything in sight? Ian Bardizek has some firsthand experience with invasive species and the Burmese python. Ian is a wildlife biologist at the Conservancy of Southwest Florida. He joins us now. Ian, welcome to 1A.
Kimberly, thank you for having me. Look forward to talking with you on this important issue.
Today's show was produced in partnership with our friends at Smithsonian Magazine. You can read the article featuring Ian, The Snakes That Ate Florida, at smithsonianmag.org. Now, Ian, first of all, what does make a species invasive?
So to get to the invasive status, you usually have to have some economic or major environmental impact. The Burmese python seems to be public enemy number one down here, and a true example of an invasive animal, as you mentioned, that are decimating our native wildlife.
Jonathan on Facebook writes, "To this day, I wonder who had the bright idea to build a breeding facility for a dangerous carnivore in a perfect habitat for it. It may have been for science, but I really hope they feel awful for the mess they've made." Ian, why have pythons become such a big problem in Southwest Florida?
Well, first and foremost, this is a product of the pet trade. You can look at CITES records that go back to the 1970s.
CITES?
Yes, the conservation on, you know, endangered species, the records that are imported here through to the United States, and hundreds of thousands of Burmese pythons have been imported into the U.S. since the 1970s.
1970s, I believe.
Yes.
You said. Yeah, I remember.
Yes.
When I was a teenager, lots of kids wanted them as pets.
Yes. I grew up in the 90s over there and went to school at Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland on the east coast of the Everglades. And I had two albino Burmese pythons in high school that a friend gave me. And they were notorious escape artists. I kept them in my house, and one of them was always getting out. And my mother has many stories about where they showed up in the house. So I think that might have been the origin story for some of our tracking that we do now here in Southwest Florida.
So you mentioned that they came to Florida in particular. Was this a national issue that Burmese pythons were being brought in as pets all over the country and Florida is just where they took root? Or was it just in Florida that they were mainly popular?
Well, it's kind of a perfect storm of situations. Florida has many ports of entry, climate, thriving pet trade. And whether snakes were intentionally released or they escaped, or, you know, there is an ongoing myth that Hurricane Andrew in 1992 was the origin of our Burmese python population. That storm did knock over a reptile breeding facility, but I've looked at the numbers and talked to my colleagues, and they were well established throughout the greater Everglades prior to that event. So if it's a multiple choice question, I'd circle D, all of the above, for how they got established.
Right. That was the breeding facility that our listener was mentioning earlier, mm-hmm. which is just, as you mentioned, one of the causes of this invasion. So what's your estimate of how many are out there? How many Burmese python are there slithering around South Florida?
Kimberly, that's the million-dollar question, and nobody really has a handle on that. You hear tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, but it's more complex than that. It's they're not so evenly distributed across the southern peninsula. There may be other scenarios where in the western portion of the state here, we're fighting a separate introduction that occurred, and that East Coast population is sort of meeting and overlapping with those as well. So the mantra is to follow the science. That's what we've been doing here at the Conservancy for the last 6 years on this project. You can't make some of these things up that we've seen. It almost reads out of a sci-fi novel of sorts, and it's crazy.
So tell us a few of those stories. Walk us through what it's like when you're out in the field trying to capture these snakes.
Oh, wow. You can't really make this up. If you told me 10 years ago we'd be tracking giant snakes here in Collier County, I wouldn't have believed you. And so 6 years ago, we formed a research collaboration with our partners, had some initial support from the U.S. Geological Survey and worked with the Department of Environmental Protection. But during that time, we've been doing the heavy lifting, literally, and we catch pythons, we insert radio transmitters inside them, let them loose, and then it's sort of a one-sided game of hide-and-seek where we let them go and follow them around to learn their behaviors. And they have revealed a pretty amazing story. And they are fascinating creatures. I just want to get that across. They're beautiful animals. They're brought here from no fault of their own. And through those years, we go where they go. And it's very much off the grid. They're showing us their movement patterns, their home ranges, their unique behavioral abilities that they have across our landscape. And I want to make an important distinction here. Don't want to be labeled that we're just studying them to death. We have very much applied that science, those findings, tracking these animals into a useful removal control tool for specific areas of the state. And during the course of the study, concurrently with our research partners at the U.S. Geological Survey, we determined that following these male pythons can lead you to reproductively active breeding females in the ecosystem. So we're using the snake's biology against them. And to that tune, hunting and tracking for these animals, since 2013, with the help of our research partners, we've removed 12,500 pounds of Burmese python from 55 square miles outside of Naples, Florida. I mean, you really just can't make that up. That's what we're dealing with over here.
We have another comment from one of our listeners about fighting invasive species the way that you've been doing.
My name is Gary. I believe it's a waste of time to fight invasive species. It is like trying to put the lid back on Pandora's box. It's here. They're here to stay. Climate change is bringing a lot of changes. Animals are going to be moving around as they adapt to the warming climate. And then with the rising oceans, the glades are going to be gone.
Ian, what's your response to Gary? Is fighting invasive species a waste of time?
Well, that's a half-empty way of looking at it. And the only constant is change, as we know. But we need to follow the science and get after this issue because our native wildlife's at stake. Those 12,500 pounds of pythons removed that I mentioned, that could be twice that in native animals that it took to reach that size and biomass. So we're witnessing the changing of our greater Everglades ecosystem real time. And what I would say to that is the Everglades is a national treasure. It's a jewel, and it's everyone's Everglades. And so this is an important issue of our time, and that's what we've been focused on here in our science department.
Very quickly, Ian, is it even possible for the pythons to be completely eliminated from the Everglades at this point?
Never say never. Eradication does seem off the table. The system will balance itself in the future. What that will look like, who knows? But as mentioned, we're in the removal phase now, working on localized control. We must save our wildlife, and that's our focus here at the Conservancy. And we need to join forces with anyone, with anybody in your listening audience there that can provide any type of assistance, technical, financial, track us down. This is an extremely important issue. And we've got our pulse, our finger on the pulse of this, and to be continued.
Ian Bartoszek is a wildlife biologist at the Conservancy of Southwest Florida. Ian, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Kimberly.
And special thanks to our partners at Smithsonian Magazine. I'm Kimberly Adams of Marketplace. Glad to be with you. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from the United States Postal Service. Every day, innovative companies are reinventing the way business happens. But none of that is possible without the right people. People who get packages to over 150 million delivery points affordably and on time with the latest technology and expertise. Who can help you deliver the future of commerce? The United States Postal Service. See why they deliver more e-commerce packages to homes than anyone in the country at usps.com/future.
It has already been an eventful summer in politics.
Yeah, between the 2020 debates and the president's battle over immigration, there's a lot going on.
And when there's news you need to know about, the NPR Politics podcast is there to tell you what happened.
Not to mention, we're hitting the road so you can meet all of the 2020 contenders.
Oh, NPR is going to drive me completely crazy.
The NPR Politics podcast.
Subscribe!
We're discussing the spread of invasive species in South Florida and across the nation. We got a flood of responses to this hour. It's clearly something that affects your day-to-day in many cases. Here's just one message from our inbox.
Hi, guys. My name is Chelsea, and I work as an environmental interpreter in Michigan, and we're seeing invasives all over the place. I think the greater question is, what is an invasive? Is it something that's actually native, that may be taking over native populations? Is it introduced and invasive, and how do we deal with that? But as our world gets more global and we start seeing these intersections of cultures, invasives are something that's never going to go away.
Paul emails from my home state of Missouri, my days are spent fighting honeysuckle, Bradford pear, Japanese beetle, and a dozen other invasive species on our farm. Our landscapes are being changed before our eyes. Anyone younger than 30 does not know what Missouri looks like without honeysuckle and pear. I'm older than 30, and I don't remember what it looks like without honeysuckle. Let's add two more voices to the conversation. Joel Trexler is a professor of biological sciences and program director of marine sciences at Florida International University. Joel, welcome to 1A.
Thank you.
And Carrie Brown Lima is director of New York Invasive Species Research Institute at Cornell University. Carrie, welcome.
Thanks, Kimberly. Great to be here.
Joel, how long have invasive species been a problem in South Florida more generally?
Well, we've had invasive species in South Florida and in the United States more broadly as long as people have been coming to these areas, because people bring with them the species, the plants and animals that they depend on, sometimes just because it reminds them of their home location. English sparrows, house sparrows were brought to the United States, for example, and into New York early on. In more modern times, we've had invasive species in South Florida that have become really gotten on the radar in terms of their impacts on people and their interests in terms of plants. The Brazilian pepper is a good example, as well as insects that affect agriculture. And these things have been on the radar for a very long time.
You mentioned some of the plants. Steve emails, can we tell Lowe's, Home Depot, and nurseries to stop selling burning bush, Japanese barberry, lemon balm, and other invasive plants? I'm getting sick and tired of pulling them out of the forests and parks. Carrie, how big of an issue are these sorts of big distribution centers of different plants that people might want to make their gardens look pretty? How big of an issue is that?
It's actually a really big issue. A lot of the invasive plants we have today actually came in with the landscape and horticulture industry. Now we have a lot greater restrictions on which ones you can bring in. And actually here in New York, we even have prohibited species. So some of those species that were listed by your listener actually aren't allowed to be sold or distributed here in New York anymore. But we call those pathways, the ways that species arrive here. And purposeful introduction for landscaping is actually one of the ways a lot of species have made it here.
Debbie emails, the impact of invasive species is often a huge domino effect. In northern Michigan, and I'm sure many other places, invasive species of plants, most often brought in for aesthetic reasons, drive out native species. These native species are the only viable host for many beneficial native insects, which then affects the birds that eat the insects. Humans can have a positive impact by choosing native trees and plants. Carrie, can you talk a little bit about the ripple effects of bringing in an invasive plant?
Well, yes. I mean, we have a lot of insects and we have a lot of interactions that have evolved over thousands, millions of years. We've got plants that insects will, one species of insects will only use that specific plant. So when an invasive species comes in, like an invasive plant that was planted and then spread, we actually eliminate the possibility of those other species surviving. There's been research done when it looks at introduced trees that are used for landscaping versus native trees, like an oak, for example. They look at the number of insects that live on that tree. The oak has way more insects available, and the birds depend on those insects. So when you decide you don't want, say, an insect to nibble on your trees in your garden, so you plant one that's from another place that doesn't have any native species that will feed on it, you're actually really hurting the wildlife and other species that depend on that for their habitat.
Let's switch back to invasive animals for a moment. And this next note from a listener.
Hi, this is Whitney in Boca Raton. When I moved here 11 years ago, the iguana population was present, but not totally out of control. And now in the last year, the iguana population has just totally blossomed, and there's huge iguanas everywhere, all over Boca Raton now.
Hello, my name is John in West Palm Beach. I live on a canal, and the iguanas have been taking over our yard. They eat our mangoes, they eat our flowers, they eat our lemons and our limes that we're trying to grow.
Hi, my name is Luis. I'm in Dania Beach, and I have a problem with iguanas on my property. There are anywhere between 5 and 10 on a daily basis, and they eat my papaya trees, flowers, and other vegetables that we grow.
Hello, my name is Connie. I live in Margate, Florida. We are inundated with iguanas, and there's different varieties, and some of them are 4 to 5 feet long. And this one day, there were 10 of them kind of running away from our building. They eat flowers and plants, and I know that other places, they do damage to seawalls and things like that.
Thank you, Whitney, John, Lewis, and Connie, for sharing your stories with us. Joel, what's the deal with iguanas in South Florida?
Well, so I'm an aquatic ecologist, but I'll tell you, you can't help but see these iguanas. They're really remarkable. Their populations have really expanded. I kind of think by analogy, we're seeing also in freshwater fish a big increase and spread of quite a few species. And I think that one thing is happening is that we have not had a very cold winter since 2010. In January of 2010, we had a very remarkable cold snap that a lot of attention has been has drawn a lot of attention because of its impact on invasive species and other tropical species that are sort of at the northern edge of their range here in South Florida. And since that time, we've just had mild winter after mild winter. And so a lot of these species that are from the tropics, like iguanas, really thrive. And the cold winters that sort of limit their range just haven't come. It might give us some insight into the future if we have warmer environments and warmer environments throughout the peninsula of Florida, for example. Some of these species might, and it's reasonable to expect, be expanding their ranges. And we might see changes in the ecology tied to that from these tropical species.
Lynn writes, I appreciate that you're giving airtime to this important issue. While climate change is discussed daily, invasive plants, which are trashing woodlands across the country with dire consequences, seem to be on few people's radar. This gets at the point of climate change playing a role in some of these species going from, as Joel mentioned, benign to invasive. Carrie, how does climate change play a role in the perpetuation of invasive species?
Well, invasive species are these super adapters. They come in, and that's what allows them to spread and become so overabundant, is the fact that they adapt to their new environment really well. And so invasive species are already in a position to adapt when the climate starts warming or we have more extreme events. So invasive species that are already present are there and ready and waiting to move. Joel mentioned about species being able to survive winters. Here in the Northeast, our winters have become much milder with less snow, much longer, warmer seasons. And some of our invasive forest pests, the insects and pathogens that kill tree species, that are usually limited by cold climates are no longer limited anymore. So we've seen their distributions marching north and being able to impact areas that we never thought they would be able to survive before. We've also seen plant species, research is showing that they can actually be resistant to herbicides in higher CO2 environments.
We have several listeners who commented on climate change and invasive species in their area.
Hi, my name is Zach, calling from Colorado. We have seen the beetles that regularly feed on the coniferous trees here just absolutely balloon over the last decade, and scientists say it's largely due to global warming. They're able to come down to lower elevations. They don't die off in the winter. And if you just take a casual drive through the Rocky Mountains, you'll see evidence of it everywhere.
I think a discussion on invasive species must include climate change, and I think that that will inform people looking forward rather than looking backward at what's there now.
Joel, are certain regions of the country, perhaps even your own, more vulnerable to invasive species due to climate change?
Set aside the climate change angle for just a second. South Florida, you know, well, certainly has an exceptional history of invasions because of our benign or milder climate, I mean to say. And we're getting a lot of species that are coming from parts of the world that are tropical, that are warmer. And they get a foothold here and become established. And then that might create a situation where those populations can then expand to other parts of the country. There's also the possibility of genetic modifications in populations that come because you introduce groups of individuals from different parts of the native range, and in the new range they interbreed in ways that might reorganize the population genetic structure and allows them to take advantage of new changes. There might be really strong selection for with a relatively small number of individuals in a new range that might enhance the frequency of individuals that have tolerances for more colder temperatures and other factors like that enhance this invasiveness element. There's a lot of interesting ecology here in more than one way that you might have species become invasive. Climate change, my thinking on this is that this represents a disturbance, if you will, or just a reorganization of environmental factors that are kind of key determinants of the list of species and their dynamics, their patterns of abundance in any geography around the world. And so the key thing about climate change isn't that, oh, it's changing, because, of course, the climates, environments have always changed. It's the rate at which change is occurring, which is unprecedented, perhaps even in geological history, to our knowledge, in many places of the world. And so this change is occurring at a pace that's faster than the biological, ecological processes that govern the formation of flora and fauna, have played out to get us to what we have today. And so that creates opportunities for species that are able to take advantage of it. You disrupt the factors that establish the kind of the norm of conditions that set the flora and fauna that we're used to seeing. You disrupt those factors, and the species that are able to take advantage most rapidly can move in and make a place for themselves.
We'll continue our conversation with Joel Trexler, a professor of biological sciences at Florida International University, and Carrie Brown Lima, director of the New York Invasive Species Research Institute at Cornell University. More in a moment. Stay close.
Support for NPR and the following message come from CarMax. For more than 25 years, CarMax has made it easy to sell your car. They provide free appraisals and offers on the spot. CarMax will buy your car even if you don't buy theirs. In fact, CarMax has bought more than 8 million vehicles. To learn more and schedule your free appraisal, visit CarMax.com.
Hey, it's Maria Hinojosa, host of NPR's Latino USA. Every week, we bring you a mix of reporting, diverse voices, and coverage of current and emerging issues that impact our lives. Latino USA is one of a kind, featuring stories from the heart, stories that make you think and maybe even inspire you to action. Listen and subscribe now.
Let's, Carrie, go back to you. There is an environmental consequence as well as possible contributor to the spread of invasive species. But what about the economic impact or health effects? How else do these invasive species touch our lives?
Well, there's a lot of ways that invasive species can cause economic harm. We have agricultural pests and weeds that cause us to lose crops and crop production. We have forest pests that are killing the trees that we use for wood products. We have lakes and rivers that we use for recreation and for transportation that when they get clogged up by invasive species, either we have to treat that invasive species or we lose tourism dollars on that lake or in that area. And so there's a lot of ways that invasive species can impact our economy. There's also the cost of trying to treat them. Landowners that have invasive forest pests come on and start killing their trees are spending millions of dollars a year to remove those trees. And so they can actually come out of taxpayer dollars, some of these economic impacts, or come out of loss in production of agriculture, but they can also hit our own wallets. And as far as health impacts, we have invasive mosquitoes that are carrying diseases and spreading diseases around. We have interactions between invasive plant species and, say, ticks that are carrying Lyme disease, where we're seeing an increase in ticks in areas that have an invasive species. So there's these interactions. And we also see species like, for example, here in New York, we have giant hogweed, where if you touch it and then are exposed to sunlight, it creates really terrible burns on your skin and can really injure your eyes if it gets in your eyes. So we
that
have
sounds
these
awful.
Yeah, it's not quite as scary seeming as a big snake, but a lot of impacts that we need to be on the lookout for and avoid some of these species as much as possible.
You mentioned those economic impacts earlier, and we have several tweets about beetles and how they're affecting things. Adam Fierst tweets, "Japanese beetles are making their way west. They've hit the Colorado Front Range hard in the last few years and are likely here to stay. Western fruit growers are scared." And Jake Dorton tweets, you mentioned taxpayer dollars. He tweeted, "I work in environmental inspection in West Virginia. We have been invaded by the ash borer beetle. As I look across a fully vegetated landscape, I see scores of dead ash trees. It's a sad state of affairs." D tweets, "My ecology professor gives extra credit for students who spend time eradicating Japanese honeysuckle and privet from natural areas. Kudzu also ate the South. I'm so tired of trying to kill it off my land." Carrie, how do you fight an invasive species?
Well, once an invasive species becomes established and spreads, it's really hard to actually remove it. We have few examples where we can, and you mentioned the word eradicate. Eradicate means get rid of it completely. Our best bet and the most cost-effective and most likely to be successful bet is when we prevent species from coming in to begin with. So through policies and behavior change, we can stop this introduction and the spread from one region to another of a species. But when that's no longer an option, once a species is kind of everywhere, it's really we're just trying to protect our assets, protect that pond that we care about, protect a tree stand that we love in our backyard. But we have a really hard time getting rid of it. There is one method that can actually, for in a long-term and sustainable way, reduce an invasive species population, and that's called biological control, where we're introducing, after a long testing and research period to make sure it's safe for introduction, it won't cause harm, introducing a predator from the native range of the invasive species that can help reduce its population and its introduced range. And so that's one of the few long-term solutions we have. And that's not possible for all species, but we do have a significant number of success stories where we've watched these kinds of biological control programs reduce populations. They have a number of examples in Florida, and we have examples here in New York and across the country as well.
And we have an example from a listener in Michigan as well.
Hi, my name is Sarah. I'm from Grand Rapids. I'm actually a conservation biologist. I work specifically with ecological restoration. A lot of that has to do with invasive species removal. For us, this is a never-ending battle, so it is a big debate. Do we do nothing or do we keep going? We hope for early detection and rapid response because that helps us eradicate it from the area. And a lot of the times it just has to do with containment and not allowing it to spread to, say, other people's properties, other types of native communities.
Carrie, can you talk a little bit more about early detection and rapid response?
So when a population is small, the best option is to prevent it from coming. The second best option in potentially winning a battle against invasives is when we can detect it when the population is small enough, so early in its invasion, and then get rid of that small population to prevent it from spreading to other places. The problem is sometimes that's like finding a needle in a haystack. We've got a huge landscape, diverse. There's places where people don't go that often or wouldn't even know how to recognize some of these species. So sometimes it's useful if we know the species that are potentially coming in, if we can keep an eye out and have volunteers or people who are working in land management agencies looking for those. And then if they do pop up in a small number, we can snuff out that population. So that's what they mean by early detection, rapid response. You detect it while it's small, and then you get rid of it quick.
Goldie tweets, "Eat the invasives away. I can think of at least half a dozen invasives in my home, Michigan, that are edible, and some even taste good. Asian carp is an invasive species in the Midwest where I'm from, and I know that people have been trying to make that a bit more appealing on dinner plates." We had some listeners weigh in with other ways that they're trying to fight against invasive species.
My name is Noreen. I live in Palm Bay, Florida. For my part, on my property, I have controlled invasive species like Brazilian pepper by removing them. I've also controlled Cuban tree frogs where I find them, which are an invasive amphibian species, and I've humanely euthanized those that I found. In addition, I've also planted all native plants in my landscaping, and I try to educate my neighbors about the value of planting natives to keep Florida free of invasive species.
Hi, my name is Toy, and I'm the owner of Puddin. We have two food trucks. I use wild blue catfish, which is an invasive species in the Chesapeake Bay watershed. There's native species there, and the wild blue catfish is causing havoc on that environment. So we are buying them up and serving wild blue catfish po' boys. So, yeah, that's how we are trying to do our part.
Thank you for leaving us those voicemails. Carrie, what else can everyday people do to confront the problem of invasive species in their communities?
Well, as I had mentioned, not spreading them around further is a really great way that people can contribute by brushing off your boots. So there's any seeds in the bottom of your boots after you take a hike. And then if you go someplace else, you're not bringing those seeds. Clean, drain, drying your boat. So getting all the water out of your boat and washing off any plant material or any organisms so that when you go from maybe an invaded lake to an uninvaded lake, you're not taking that along with you. There's recommendations not to move firewood. So if you're going to camp far from your home, don't take your firewood with you because you might bring along some hitchhiking invasive forest pests. And so those are all small changes that we can make in our own lives to stop avoiding them.
Joel, at what point does an invasive species become so pervasive in an area that it's just part of the native species at that point, or at least part of the accepted ecology of the environment?
I'm not aware of any technical criterion that we would use for that, but there are plenty of examples of species that have become naturalized and which people think of as a part of their fauna or flora, but in fact were introduced at some time maybe in the distant past. In fact, if you're having trouble now with problems of other invasive species harming your European honeybees and we're losing the services they provide for pollination, and there's an invasive species harming a naturalized species that was introduced, but it's useful for us.
Todd tweets, "Let's not forget that we, Homo sapiens, are the original and most destructive invasive species. Invasive species are not bad per se. They are just doing what Mother Nature intended, exploiting an ecological niche." Carrie Brown Lima, director of New York Invasive Species Research Institute at Cornell University, thanks for being on 1A.
Thank you, Kimberly.
And Joel Trexler, professor of biological sciences and program director of marine sciences at Florida International University. Thank you.
Thank you.
This show was produced by Haley Blassingame with help from Paige Osborne. It was edited by Orion Donovan Smith and was made possible with help from Smithsonian Magazine. You can read The Snakes That Ate Florida, featuring guest Ian Bartizek, on their website, smithsonianmag.org, and find out much more about their work on our website, the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Kimberly Adams. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.